Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Hedge, a podcast from Scribehound, where we go in search of the people, places, traditions, and tales that shape Britain's rural landscape. Some weeks ago, which I think I've already mentioned in a previous episode, I spent a very happy Tuesday standing behind the counter in the West London butcher's shop, H.G. Walter, for a piece for the Financial Times magazine. About five customers over the course of the day came in wanting calf's liver. Not so long ago, offal was thought of as being what you had when you couldn't afford anything better. One veteran magazine editor I know, who is in his early 60s, told me he never eats tongue anymore because he remembers that it was what they started having for Sunday lunch in the 70s when the stock market crashed and his dad lost his job. But when I was at H.G. Walter, Moran Berger, a chef-turned-butcher who I spent a lot of the day chatting to, explained to me that, in London anyway, people eating offal seems to be on the rise. They've seen a 50% growth in tongue sales over the past 3 years, and they sell out of liver almost every day. But across the UK, the picture is more complicated. John Metrick, who owns Metrick Butchers in Derbyshire, says fewer and fewer customers opt for offal in the north. Tripe and heart, he notes, used to fly off the shelves, but they ended up throwing away more than they sold in the end, and now they don't really stock so much of it at all. Depressingly, he says that the main outlet for lamb's hearts is probably for children to dissect in school biology classes. While I was researching the piece for the FT, I ended up having a drink with a young butcher called Flossie Phillips, who, when she's not behind the counter, cooked offal across London. Her take is that offal is the very essence of an animal, and she's on a one-woman mission to get people to eat more of it. I think we'd had about three glasses of wine when I suggested that I could get her some squirrel and some pigeon, with the heart, liver, and kidneys included. I'm doing a podcast series, I told her vaguely, and offal, I think, would make for a good episode. About a fortnight later, I was standing in the woods in North Norfolk on the banks of the River Stiffkey, which is a really pretty little chalk stream. I was with my friend Sachin Qureshi. It was a warm spring day with almost no wind, and there were pigeons coming in to roost. Sachin's a screenwriter, and he spends most of his life in Acton, West London, but over the years, through hanging out with me, he's developed an interest in shooting things and cooking them. We've been muntjac stalking over the years and fishing, and we even went ferreting once. He wrote a very amusing piece about it. The plan was to get a couple of pigeons that were eating the landowner's rapeseed crop, and we were also on the lookout for squirrels that get at his walnuts.
It's really starting to feel pretty spring-like. It's probably been the warmest day of the year so far.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And we're just by the River Stiffkey, which is an amazing chalk stream river in Norfolk. I think with sea trout in it, actually, although I've never seen it.
But the spring-summer isn't so good for you in terms of the hunting.
In terms of shooting.
It's not.
Well, I guess the really interesting thing is, like, you don't go out shooting so much in the summer, but summer is when everything you shoot has a good time. So these pigeons are all flying really high today.
And what are we looking for when they come low and they go into the trees?
Exactly, that's exactly what we're looking for. But they can kind of do whatever they want because it's such a nice day and because there isn't a hard wind. They can kind of do their own thing and make it up as they go along. So let's head on into the wood.
Very high bird. Any luck?
No. But every time that you take a pigeon with it, it's like on the move, it's hard. And let's go and jump in. So to load up, you drop two cartridges in. And this is not easy. That's really important to kind of recognize that it's not easy. And it's also...
You have to be patient, of course.
You have to be patient. If you do something wild, then it's probably not going to work out. So I'll help you out. If you stand in here and... So is the goal? Yeah. And then we should say to people listening, Sachin's shot a few times before, but...
A little bit of practice.
So, if you close the gun up and then point the gun up skywards and have it out of your shoulder, just in the piece of your shoulder there.
Yeah.
Okay, that was quick.
What about there? Oh, good. I was on safety.
I always think that roost shooting is one of the most enjoyable forms of pigeon shooting. As ever, when you're taking on wild quarry and you're trying to harvest wild things for the table, it all starts with reconnaissance. You've got to know what the pigeons are doing in a particular wood, but what they'll generally be doing is flying into warm trees at the end of a hard day's feeding. So that might be fir trees, it could be ivy on the trunks of hardwoods. In this case, it was fir trees. And what you really want is a windy, wintry day, because pigeons always land into the wind. And if you've got a windy day, then they land quite slowly into the wind. We didn't have a windy, wintry day. We had a very pleasant spring day. But, you know, half of the fun of these things is that you've just got to do your best, no matter what the conditions are.
Just let it come in the background. It's about patience. So that's the thing. So when you fight, they kind of disperse and then they'll start to drop in, because this is where they want to be. And you can kind of see with the feathers on the ground that this is where they've been roosting these treetops, because it gives them quite a lot of warmth. There we go. Have that.
God.
Okay.
You go.
So look, I'll have a go. But I mean, it's really hard.
With clays, I mean, the rate at which you're having a go, I mean, now you have to be so patient. Patrick, couple up there, mate.
Should have had that.
Couple there, coming around.
I'm rusty. See that there coming down? Mark it. Okay. Let's see if I can get one more.
There's another one, Patrick. You see it? Oh.
Okay, look, let's go and retrieve what we've shot. We can see the feathers coming down there. You see this here, this goose egg. Feels as though it's dead. But let's go and see if we can find this pigeon. Do you think, are those feathers though? You keep looking for it. I'll run and get Jessie.
Okay.
So we just got Jessie from the car, young Jessie. She's only a year old. She's going to come and help us find this pigeon. Jessie, just steady at heel, please. Good girl, just steady at heel. It's always good to try and find whatever it is you've shot. Where is it, Jessie? Find it, Jessie. Find it, Jessie. Good girl, fetch it up. Fetch it. Good girl, Jessie. Well done, Dad. Okay, I'll try and shoot one more wood pigeon. See this one here, come in and see. So you keep tight. Keep tight. Okay, I think that'll do.
Just after Jessie retrieved her first pigeon, I turned around and there was a grey squirrel running through the branches. So I fired at it and it fell straight away. Grey squirrels can be quite hard to shoot, but this one was dead, I think, before it tumbled into the wild garlic. It was dead on the branch, which is always the way you want these things to go. So the following week, as arranged, I called up Flossie and I said to her, I've got the grey squirrel, I've got the pigeon, I've plucked and skinned, ready for you to come round and cook. So she said to me she'd come straight over, but she thought she'd maybe be a little while because she was going to look for some fennel and some various other things that she wanted to use in cooking them on the way to my house.
You're a butcher by kind of trade, is that?
Yes.
But you do lots of other things. You kind of, did you start off in the art world?
I did. Before I was a butcher, I was an art dealer. So I've gone from selling fine art to fine meats.
You've got the pluck there, right, on the blade.
Mm.
And what is, so you've got the heart?
The heart and the liver. Yeah.
Which are quite big.
Which are really quite actually substantial. If you're looking at like the size of the carcass, if you think what they're doing. And the kidneys are, I don't know if the kidneys are still in there. No, I think, oh, they are. They're lying really flat against the, and they're actually quite large. So they're lying really flat. And you can see.
Have you ever cooked with wood pigeon kidney before?
Well, I've tried, but I'm so strong. I just crush them in my fingers. They're really, really difficult to keep intact.
Oh, really?
I probably need properly, you know, surgical equipment to do that.
And is that not the same with other kidneys and other?
No, other kidneys are a lot more. It's the same with chickens. I mean, I don't know if that's kind of a genetic special thing, but they're almost watery. Whereas sort of the more four-legged mammals seem to have a lot more bounce and structure.
Yeah.
Before we get carried away, why are we here in my kitchen cooking offal? What's your thing?
My thing really is offal. It's about reinvigorating and reintroducing it to our meat awareness, like the lexicon of what is meat to kind of cook with, to eat, and also in terms of a butcher's perspective, it's the idea of the whole animal. So people talk about sort of nose to tail and things like that, but I'm really trying to re-homogenize offal in with what we consider meat or food.
I think you said to me that offal is almost like the essence of an animal. Is that kind of how you think of it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of taking such inspiration from the holy being that is Fergus Henderson. But Fergus Henderson,
for those of you who don't know, is sort of a pioneering restaurant owner. And I mean, how long has his restaurant been running for now? It's been running for a
good while. It opened in the 90s.
His restaurant, St. John, which is like a much-loved place of people like Anthony Bourdain and Tim Adams, actually, who we had on the podcast earlier on in the series.
Yes.
So there we've got so you've basically taken the whole skeleton out, right?
Yeah, intact.
Wow.
And so it's completely debugged. Well, it's still got the wing bones and the leg bones.
And what are you planning to do? Are you going to kind of use the offal as like a stuffing for it?
Well, we could do that, but I was actually going to stuff it with a simnel cake.
Oh, wow, of course. Yeah, it's like a post-Easter thing.
Because what floffle is I use the term being a domestic scavenger, because scavenger is relatively off-putting.
Floffle's like your kind of concept.
Floffle is my, yeah, I suppose it's becoming a brand now, which I find quite awkward to say, right? But it is a brand. It's really an approach. And funnily enough, I'm here with blood all over my hands and holding caressing hearts and livers, but actually floffle could be vegan if it wanted to be, because it's this approach about reigniting this curiosity about your food, finding it.
I like that I found this flying into a tree in Norfolk and you found this stuff here.
Well, there you go.
On the way over from the other side of Camberwell. What is this stuff, this greenery that we've got
here
in front of us? So we've
got this lovely sweet fennel that was in, I mean, I'm about a stone's throw from your house, actually, on a little patch by where the cars were parked. And then this is sort of a wild allium. I don't actually know. It's some sort of variation on wild garlic, but it looks a bit like wild garlic stems or spring onion with beautiful white flowers. It's a bit milder than wild garlic, and that was in Brunswick Park, and it's all over London.
I was reading they also call this Florence fennel.
That's very
sweet. Which is quite appropriate, really.
Yes, it is. Yes, very,
but you spend much of your time standing behind a butcher's counter in London.
I do.
And how much demand is there for offal? How many pig's kidneys do you shift in a good morning?
The poor pigs, they're offal. They really, really don't get much of a look in. And I mean, being totally truthful, pork offal is the least flavorful. Just for me personally, it's not to say that you can make it incredibly, incredibly delicious, but it's sort of milder in color and in appearance, and it's very difficult to shift pork kidneys. People think about kidneys and they think lamb's kidneys, and it is frustrating when you try and give someone an alternative. You say it's a kidney at the end of the day. It's going to have the same kind of slightly smoky flavour, and a pork kidney is bigger and milder, so actually it's more of a gateway.
And do people want offal at all? I mean, do you find that when you get offal in, it just sits there for a long time? Or what is it that people are going for in terms of offal?
It's really sporadic. People love calf's liver. The calf's liver is very established, has its place on restaurant menus. You know, in terms of all meat, people are incredibly led by what they see on restaurant menus and what they read in their recipe books. So, you know, there's these times where Jamie Oliver or Nigella's done a recipe. If they did something with kidneys, I'm sure people would come flying in, but they don't. And I think people sort of see it as an exception, as a bit of a stunt, as something that's, I find, ironically, almost, you know, exotic.
Are you conscious of not just being like a girl in your mid-20s doing something that's a bit kind of gross with lots of bloody things? Or like, how do you kind of work that one? Because you were telling me once you ate like some fox or something.
I did eat fox.
I think even for me, that might be a little bit much. Because you're a chef as well. Are you looking back at things people used to do in the past in terms of cooking, or are you doing kind of new innovative things? Because I think part of the problem is, if I flick through recipe books of mine, I don't really see much in there for offal, unless I'm maybe looking at like a Clarissa Dixon Wright recipe book or something like that. But that's kind of quite vintage now and sort of almost quite kitsch. So where do you draw inspiration from in terms of cooking offal?
Draw it from cooking anything else, really. I mean, it's part of, I suppose, what I'm trying to do is, when I've got an ox heart, I look up beef recipes.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And then I think, oh, okay, well, someone's done a fillet with a parsnip puree and blah, 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 and all of this stuff and all of those different profiles and techniques. And I think, oh, okay, well, heart is just another cut of beef.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's even beefier in a lot of ways. So I just go by that, really. But what I love about offal in terms of being a chef is because it is that bit more exceptional to me and special, and I think really needs to be celebrated, it actually pushes me to be more creative as a chef. And it gives me confidence to try something out. And I think a lot of people can benefit from that. If you want to, if you're already using something and you've got your basis as something that is pretty extraordinary or quite unique, or maybe a bit, I'm going to really use inverted commas here, wacky, it will maybe push you to kind of throw everything out the window and just go, you know what? Yeah, fuck it. I mean, I am going to pair this with some blue cheese or and I think, and that's always been my approach to cooking because I'm essentially self-taught, and that's the fun of it because it just triggers this curiosity. And then you kind of get this rush of just like, I can do anything.
One of the things that I think has been quite fun about this episode is that I was with my friend in Norfolk, who comes from Shepherd's Bush. He is like, his dad's Pakistani. He doesn't really go to the countryside. He once said to me that he only goes to the countryside to go to Glastonbury, which was kind of a bit of a joke. And he's since like quite enjoyed fishing with me a couple of times and whatever. But he would say himself, look like a kind of normal country person, right, which I think he kind of finds quite fun. And you don't look, I wouldn't say, like a normal, everyday, chubby butcher kind of
No,
thing.
Thank you so much for noticing.
I mean, are you one of a very few butchers who's kind of a woman in your mid-20s with like lots of glittery eye makeup, or are there more of you?
I think there's more of us. I think there's a younger, more importantly, there's certainly a younger generation of butchers coming to the fore, and I think they're using your hands, kind of just using your body and your senses. The thing about butchery for me, which I adore, is that it is utterly immersive. It's quite hypnotic, actually.
Yeah.
When you're just breaking down a carcass and all you need to worry about is, well, not cutting yourself, but actually more importantly, not damaging the meat. And you become entranced in looking after this thing. I know it's dead, but I hear myself apologizing to a carcass sometimes if I make a wrong cut.
If you treat it badly.
Because it's just so, so beautiful, and it takes you outside of yourself. And
can you tell me, as somebody who knows more about this than I do, so I shot this.
Yes.
Shot it pretty hard by the looks of things.
Yeah.
What's going on here? If somebody brought this into your butcher shop, would you say, this isn't in good enough nick to sell, or what's good? Because we've got quite a lot of blood.
We've got quite a lot of trauma. So I doubt I would be able to say I would be taking that breast home.
Really?
For
really?
Myself, yeah. But the other one I could tidy up and it would be absolutely
Which
fine.
Which is actually a really interesting problem, though, in terms of game and how we get people to eat. I mean, it's not unlike getting people to eat more offal, except for, you know, because this is hunted in the wild.
Yeah. But you see pigeon on menus, and you see a whole pigeon, and they can be, it can be done in such a delicate, beautiful way that there's something I think people find absurd, even obscene, about offal because it's exposing the insides in a very brutal, literal way that people don't normally see.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
conveniently. What's even more inconvenient is that it resembles all those vital organs are symbolic of a living, breathing, feeling thing.
Agree.
People do not like that point of near empathy. The intimacy, that's precisely what drives me, is the intimacy that I have with the animal and the product and everything it represents. That's really what fuels me, because and that's my inspiration, because I want to respect that. But for a lot of people, it's far too much. The number of times people say to me, oh yeah, I don't mind, I think I try most things, but I draw the line at brain. And I say,
really?
Why do you draw the line at brain? Oh, it's just too much. And I'm like, no, sorry, go on, why is it too much?
Yeah.
And they just can't get past
it. I guess there's a thing that, like, you know, one doesn't think, oh, that's my ribeye, that's my T-bone, that's my, do you know what I mean?
No, Denver they don't steak. Think of
whereas,
it as a muscle.
Whereas, yeah. whereas with offal, like, we all know that we've got kidneys. We all know we've got
exactly.
a liver. So it's that relationship,
yeah.
which is a little bit
It's that level of intimacy. And I use the word intimacy a lot in my work. And people, I think, find it quite uncomfortable. And they sort of think that I'm almost being perverse. And I can understand that.
There
as well.
Is a little bit of that. In
yeah,
the sort
I get
of
it.
Henderson
I get it.
Stuff. And we're kind of improvising here with a few of my better knives. But what... Like, as a butcher, what do you recommend people at home get? What does everybody need?
What, for knives?
Yeah, knives, scissors, like maybe like poultry shears or whatever they call them. You know, yeah. What's essential if you kind of fancy yourself as a...
Really decent pair of scissors, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, and for example, in prepping offal, all those little nodules that you get with kidneys...
Right.
I can't be arsed with a knife. You're just constantly, it's really not that efficient. Just get a pair of kitchen scissors sort of snip away. So I would say that get yourself like a nice, decent, you can have a lovely Japanese knife. I mean, again, I improvise and stuff, and actually your best tools, and I would say this in butchery as well, with care, the best tool is your hand. Because your hands can feel around and your hands map it out. And I try often, my old master butcher used to tell me off so much. He said, get your hands out of the way. But really it helps me so much because it's just a way of sort of like reading the anatomy and then my knife follows.
How long does the training take? And is offal a big part of training to be a butcher or not?
It depends. So I've not done an apprenticeship. I think that they're going to the place that I'm at the moment, they're going to enroll me into one. But really, I'm almost half self-taught. I came into it before I was doing...
What is that there that you're pulling out?
So this is like the remnants of the pluck. So this is the lungs.
Has been shot quite hard through there?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, you can
and the little
see
heart.
Where it... Yeah. It's not too bad.
It's not too bad.
No.
There's just sort of congealed blood here. Blood. So I'm just going to cut through the esophagus there. Do you know what? I think there's a sweetbread. I might be wrong.
And sweetbread, just for people listening, is what?
It's a little thing. It's a gland. So sweetbreads can either be a thyroid or a pancreatic gland. I mean, I'm guessing because this would be the same as a lamb's. Quite often you'll get a lamb's pluck and it's hanging down there. So you've got the heart, the lungs. And this is really interesting. Look at the pigeon heart in comparison to the squirrel heart.
I guess they live quite different lives.
They do.
So, Flossie, you know quite a lot about wine as well, don't you? That's one of your...
I'm learning. I'm getting there, yes.
So the people who very kindly let me shoot the squirrel have just started this little vineyard here, and we've got a bottle of it, so I thought it would be appropriate to have...
Oh, I think so,
the,
absolutely.
The Walsingham squirrel with the... Walsingham white.
No, I love that. I think that's, again, it's that approach. I mean, that's quite floffle in a way because you're just finding everything that's there. You're making do, you're embracing the whole environment and everything that's readily there. You know, you're not going out of your way to construct something formulaic.
So you were saying to me that venison offal is probably your favourite type of offal to cook with. Is that like muntjac, you were saying, right? Why is muntjac so good?
I don't know what it was. I mean, the place where I'm working, butcher shop in Mayfair right now, we get all the beef and the lamb and the venison is completely wild from Derslade Estate and the farms attached to that. And I've been deer stalking with Ben Carter, who's just the most extraordinary man ever, so knowledgeable. And he shot this muntjac for me because I just really wanted the offal. And I asked and he said, well, no one ever takes the offal. You can just have it, please. And I went deer stalking with him in the morning before I was going to work, going to butcher, and we didn't see anything. And I was quite sort of put out, trying to carry on with my day. And then he just turned up, and in the back of his pickup was this muntjac. And they just looked like these extraordinarily, like, fantastical creatures. With
fangs. They're very old deer. They're one of the oldest types of deer, quite interestingly. They're sort of unchanged for a very, very long time.
Yeah, they're almost like prehistoric kind of nature.
And what characterizes the offal? Why is it so good?
It was just sweet. It was smoky. You imagine what they eat, this kind of, like, very raw... herbaceous, woody, like sap. It had. Yeah. It was just really, really unique. But then it had this specific, like, gamey undertone to it. It just kept going. The flavor kept going. It's like almost like a really fortified wine or like a stock. And it was extraordinary. It just hit us both. And I was cooking it with a very, very good chef, actually, a very dear friend, Douglas McMaster, who owns Silo.
Oh, right,
and Sino have recently put squirrel on their menu.
Oh, really?
Because it's so sustainable.
I wonder where they get it from.
We both just sat back in our chairs and were like, we just couldn't talk. We were speechless. And he used to work at St. John and he's a very, very good chef, very established. And he said, I think that's the best offal I've ever eaten. So it was really magical.
So I just got a little Saturday job supplying Muntjac to a farm shop in Norfolk, which is actually where the squirrel comes from, to the Walsingham farm shop. But I don't think they're going to have any demand for the offal. So I might be able to supply you with Muntjac offal from time to time.
I would be
going forward if you've got a use for it.
Absolutely, I'd be honoured.
I think otherwise Jesse the Spaniel, who's under stairs, will be getting it. So these, Lottie, are the legs we've got cooking here, right?
Yeah, I've got the legs, the shoulders,
the offal in there, or the offal's not in there yet?
No. I'm just going to really quickly sear the offal.
Offal generally doesn't need that much cooking, is that right?
No, it doesn't. And I think a lot of people think of it as stews or kidneys in second kidney pie, but you can't see it, or it's just muddled in. You know, it's like disguised, and it's not celebrated. And actually, really, that's what I'm trying to do a lot of the time when I'm cooking. And as a chef, my dishes, you get a heart on the plate. You get a liver steak on a plate. You don't get it finely sliced, so it just looks like sort of anonymous meat.
Where do you think we're at in terms of, like, if you read, you know, Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier or whatever, he writes a lot about offal butchers. And that was all they sold. And offal was definitely seen as being something that was very much for people who didn't have much money at all. And that was kind of the only cut they could afford, right? Or the only kind of meat they could afford would be like tripe, particularly. Like, where are we at now with it? Do you think has it almost completely shifted to being a kind of delicacy?
I think so, in a way. I mean, a lot of very, very well-respected, very trendy restaurants are using it. But it's that bigger... That, I think, is really it filtering into whole carcass and being more sustainable. And there is, I guess, an art to it because it is a little bit different. So a lot of the time people will make significant effort to cook with it and to make it really beautiful and palatable.
You can smell that squirrel.
And
now.
Aesthetic. It's amazing, isn't it? It's really sort of like
and how
sweet.
Easy is it, I mean, to... The funny thing is, I mean, where we are here, you've got local halal butchers who sell a lot of offal, tripe particularly. But how easy is it for people ordinarily to buy offal from their local butcher? Do they have to kind of ask
really
you to order
easy.
It in? Or
I
is
mean,
it?
Yeah. Well, every side of pork and every lamb that you're getting come with their kidneys, because the abattoir will slash the kidneys to show the health of the animal.
Wow.
So you can almost always, if you've got a whole carcass butcher, that you can certainly almost guarantee that you will get
kidney. Why is it that the kidneys show the health of the animal? What's
it's just the colour of it, so you can see. So if you've got a nasty grey kidney, it's not very fresh.
I think that in the States they're quite into eating them, because obviously that's where grey squirrels are from originally.
Yeah.
So they have these dogs called squirrel dogs that chase the squirrels up the tree, and then they stand underneath barking, so you know where the squirrel is. But it's kind of interesting that, because they've not actually been in this country that long.
How long have they been here?
I think literally like not much more than like 100 years. So what the guy who introduced Muntjac deer, one of the, well, supposedly, although he was involved, but I think other people were involved, one of the Dukes of Bedford, he released Muntjac at Woburn Abbey, and then his son spread them around the country.
Oh, yes, yeah.
He also liked, if anybody invited him to a party, he would give them a gift of a pair of squirrels, which was like, sort of, I guess at the time was kind of fun, but not people wish he hadn't. Sort of a random question, but... Can you freeze offal as well as you can freeze any other type of meat, or how does that work?
Yeah, you can, definitely. I mean, quite often you'll get things like sweetbreads you have to sort of buy per kilo, and they're almost always frozen. Same with brains. And that's absolutely fine, to be honest. Ox hearts, anything really muscular and kind of meaty, that freezes really well.
Yeah, yeah.
The only really real thing is liver, actually.
Doesn't freeze so well. Why is that?
It's just, it's something to do with the structure of it. I can't really tell. It just becomes a bit pappy.
What if you covered the squirrel liver in?
Pepper.
All right. Just, there's some thyme there though as well, isn't there?
Mm.
So is that the squirrel kidneys have just gone
kidneys
in?
Kidneys and the heart's gone in. And wow. I'm just going to put the liver in as well.
I like to think that people who really know their squirrel offal at home can hear the difference.
Yes, they
the
can.
Different notes,
yeah, you can just
there.
Hear the density.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I? It's so beautiful that I don't actually want to eat any of it, but can I?
Let's dive in.
So, look, I'm going to just jump in at the deep end with a squirrel kidney. I'm going to half it and have it with a little nut. That's really nice. Really strong.
Is it?
It's yeah, it is strong. No, it's not bitter.
Those squirrel kidneys really were strong, but they were strong in a good way. They were peppery and sweet and nutty. They were, I guess, what you'd imagine squirrel would taste like. We then had an incredible pigeon dish with the heart in the middle, but it had the liver in there, really a very big liver, and the three-cornered leek was around the outside. It was a very honest tribute to what pigeon is, and I think that's what I like so much about Flossie's cooking. I think so much of eating meat is, in the modern world anyway, is kind of shying away from what it is, you know, sausages, burgers, and so on. Whereas Flossie really faces meat head on in a very raw way, but I think in quite a beautiful way. She really appreciates what it is she's cooking. She's got some events coming up in London. We'll post a link to her Instagram in the show notes so you can head along. They sell out very quickly, but they're amazing events. She does some really fascinating stuff. I was thinking a bit about, you know, what people who are listening can do to get on board with Offal and to kind of make Offal a bit of a bigger thing. If you're lucky enough to be able to go out deer stalking or pigeon shooting, then, you know, keep that Offal. I mean, I certainly know in the past when I've been muddjack stalking and pigeon shooting, I've sometimes just given the Offal to my dog, which is a nice thing to do, or I've even just thrown it away, which is a real shame, I think. So I'm going to stop doing that. You know, I think it's important to try and eat every bit of an animal we can. And then, you know, if you live near a good butcher, why not ask them for some? I said when I was in HG Walter, what would you recommend for people who are eating offal for the first time? And the butcher there, one of the butchers, a really nice guy called Tom, said ox heart. He said ox heart's a great thing. He said get it on the barbecue, have it with some mustard or whatever, and it's just brilliant. So, you know, hopefully we'll get some hot days soon. And why don't you ask your butcher to get ox heart in if they don't stock it ordinarily, and you could get some of the Walsingham white wine. I believe they had a very good harvest last time round, so they're due to have a lot of wine quite soon. It's very good stuff, so why don't you do that? Hopefully we'll have some hot days soon, and you can get the barbecue fired up. If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not take a moment to leave us a review? 5 stars is always appreciated. It helps this podcast, Beyond the Hedge, become more visible to those who are out there browsing. And it helps us to tell people a bit more about the British countryside.